That's what issue one is about. Make no mistakes about it. As a dad of two girls, it's about having that girl be able to be raped and having the rapist force her to have an abortion, all without your consent as a minor. That is insane.
That is insane. Ohio Republican U.S. Senate candidate Bernie Marino. It's also insanely untrue.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
Not that you care.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
Gotta lie to win.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair.
If you're a Republican
and
in Ohio.
I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
I am. From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is The Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA, 98.7 in Santa Barbara, 93.7 in San Diego, 99.5 in Ridgecrest and China Lake, California. Also in California, in Red Bluff and Redding. I hope to talk about Redding a little bit today on KFOI. And Round Mountains, KKRN. Up in Oregon on the Central Coast on KYAQ. Cottage Grove's KSO. Eugene's KEPW. Lanchester, Pennsylvania's W News. Maui, Hawaii's KAKU. In Columbus, Ohio on WGRN. Palinville, New York's WLPP. Rochester, New York's WRFZ. Down in New Orleans on WHIV. Out in Gallup, New Mexico on KNIZ. Concord, New Hampshire's WNHN, Fayetteville, Arkansas's KPSQ, in Seattle on KODX, Janesville, Wisconsin's Janesville, Wisconsin's WADR, Minneapolis, St. Paul's, oh boy, AM 950, KTNF.
You'll get it one of these days.
Yeah, right. Who asked you? We also stream coast to coast and around the globe on the internet, so the Progressive Voices Channel, Netroots Radio, Radio for Humans, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, No Lies Radio, Verdant Square Radio, Detour Talk, and most of your favorite podcast sites. Blanketing Planet Earth, I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me from bradblog.com. Thank you very much for joining us today. And of course, as you can see, Desi Doyen is standing by. As soon as I get into trouble here on any particular thing.
To jump in and help out.
Good to see you, Desiree. Thank you for the help in advance. By the way, Election Day is Tuesday, which is what I really want to talk about. And I will. But we've got these big stories that, once again, we got to get out of the way a little bit here. That are mostly being focused on by the corporate media today, including Donald Trump's testimony. On the stand in New York State's $250 million civil fraud trial against the disgraced, twice impeached, four-time criminally indicted former president and his company and several top executives at the Trump Organization, including his two eldest sons, Don Jr. and Eric, both of whom testified in the New York civil trial last week, which stands to end the Trump's decades-old real estate business empire, which has already been found by the judge overseeing the case to have been built on decades of fraud by the Trumps. State Attorney General Letitia James has charged that the Trumps overinflated the assets of the company by just a little bit, approximately $2.2 billion over each of the years from 2011 to 2021. That is the focus of this suit. And in doing so, Trump fraudulently received favorable terms on bank loans while undervaluing financial statements to get lower insurance rates on his properties. Now, of course, he is claiming that, it's real estate and figuring out the value of things is more an art than a science. The problem, and that could be, you could make that argument, except for the fact that at the very same time that he was inflating the worth of his properties by hundreds of millions of dollars, for example, down in Mar-a-Lago, where he said it was worth, I can't remember, $100 million or $200 million, when the Palm Beach County Assessor said it was worth $14 million. Now, he might think it's worth $100 million or $200 million. The problem is, and he could say that's what I believe it's worth, et cetera. And that's an argument that you could make, except for the fact that at the very same time, he was telling different people, whether it's the IRS or insurance companies, oh, Mar-a-Lago, that's not worth nothing. That's worth $18 million, $14 million. You can't have it both ways unless, of course, you're a criminal and or you are Donald Trump. Now, Don Jr. and Eric, as noted, already testified on the stand last week. Trump's daughter, Ivanka, is set to follow Trump on the stand this week. The former president has reportedly had a number of tense exchanges with the judge during his testimony on Monday, which is being described by those in the courtroom as rambling and meandering, in a case which the judge has already sanctioned Trump twice for violating a gag order preventing him from attacking the judge's staff. Even before the trial itself started, he had found the Trumps guilty of the key fraud charges filed against them. New York Attorney General Tish James, in the past hour or so after court got out for the day, offered some comments following Donald Trump's testimony.
He rambled. He hurled insults. But we expected that. At the end of the day, the documentary evidence demonstrated that, in fact, he falsely inflated his assets to basically enrich himself and his family. He continued to persistently engage in fraud. The numbers don't lie. And Mr. Trump obviously can engage in all of these distractions, and that is exactly what he committed on the stand today, engaging in distractions and engaging in name-calling. But I will not be bullied. I will not be harassed. This case will go on. We look forward to hearing the testimony of Ivanka Trump on Wednesday, and then we plan on closing our case. And then there'll be some motions on Thursday, and then the defense will present their case in chief. Justice will prevail, and it's important that all of you understand that we have already been victorious in our motion for summary judgment, and now we look forward to disgorgement and to the remaining counts in our action against Donald Trump and his repeated and consistent fraud against the citizens of the great state of New York.
I look forward to it, too. There will, of course, be much coverage of Trump's testimony on Monday elsewhere. Though, if you want to ring in on it, I'm all ears. I'm hoping to open up the phones a little bit later this hour at 818-985-5735. 818-985-KPFK if you'd like to queue up right now. Also, the death toll continues to rise in the Gaza Strip under the relentless bombing campaign by Israel in response to the October 7th attack on Israel by Hamas, which killed at least 1,300. In response, the Hamas-run health agency in Gaza now reports that more than 10,000 have been killed in Gaza, including now, they say, more than 4,000 children. Hamas still holds at least 240 hostages following their horrific attack on October 7, both civilian and military, and Israel's far-right government has vowed that there will be no ceasefire, at least until those hostages are released. Calls for an immediate ceasefire around the U.S. and indeed around the world have increased in recent days. The Biden administration, meanwhile, and its Secretary of State Antony Blinken, in pretty much nonstop shuttle diplomacy at this point across the region in recent days, they have been pressing the Israeli government for what they describe not as a ceasefire, but as a humanitarian pause to allow more humanitarian aid into Gaza civilians and the release of more foreign nationals, hostages, and civilians through the checkpoint from Gaza out to Egypt. The heads of 18 UN agencies, meanwhile, called on Israel to implement a, quote, immediate humanitarian ceasefire. And 35 Jewish and Arab peace and human rights groups in Israel called for a ceasefire in Gaza, the release of Israeli hostages kidnapped by Hamas, and a political and diplomatic solution to the conflict. According to the Israeli newspaper Haaretz, U.S. Secretary of State Blinken met with the Turkish foreign minister on Monday in Ankara to discuss the Israel-Hamas conflict in hopes of preventing a regional escalation. Blinken said they discussed, quote, efforts to significantly expand humanitarian assistance and how to, quote, set the conditions for a durable, sustainable, lasting peace for Israelis and Palestinians. U.S. President Joe Biden spoke once again with Israel Prime Minister Netanyahu on Monday, purportedly to press the far-right leader on similar measures. As noted, you'll find a lot of coverage of that elsewhere today, so I do want to try and focus in on a few issues not receiving the attention that I think they deserve today with everything else that is going on. It is Election Day on Tuesday in a number of states around the country, and we are now just less than 1 year away from the critical 2024 presidential election. Some believe that what happens on Tuesday this week may foreshadow either good news or bad for each of the major parties in advance of next year's elections. I'm somewhat agnostic on that, but it will certainly inform the parties on where they may need to shore up or otherwise rethink their plans for next year, with primary elections kicking off in a matter of months for 2024. And by the way, what is currently scheduled to be the final GOP presidential primary debate, that is scheduled for this Wednesday night, Desi Doyen, in Florida.
Should be fun.
Well,
kind of surprised they're holding another one since it doesn't seem to be doing much good, but we'll see what happens.
Well, I don't know how much good it's doing. Donald Trump doesn't bother to show up, and they've had pretty easy questions until now. The first two were actually hosted by Fox. This
True.
One will be hosted by NBC. So maybe there will be real journalists there who may ask actual questions.
We shall see.
We will see. And we will, of course, have special coverage for whatever it is worth on our Thursday broadcast this week. But as to Tuesday's elections, there are key gubernatorial races in two usually very Republican states. The popular Democratic governor of Kentucky, Andy Beshear, is up for re-election. And in even, well, supposedly deeper red Mississippi, the less than wildly popular governor, Republican Governor Tate Reeves, is seeking a second term, running against challenger Democrat Brandon Presley. Yes, actually a second cousin of Elvis's, by the way. As Presley has been pressing to move African Americans to the polls in the state where 40% of the population in Mississippi is black. But turnout by those voters has been historically low, going back for years. This year, however, could be different. We'll see. In that a decades-old Jim Crow law, actually longer than decades, I think it goes back to the 1800s, which had required gubernatorial candidates to not only win the statewide popular vote to be elected, but also to win the majority in each of the state legislative districts across the state. That law has finally been overturned. This will be the first gubernatorial election to run without it. Now, under that law, the old law, if the statewide candidate did not win in each district in the state, then the winner of the governor's race would be decided by the GOP-controlled state legislature, which kept a lot of folks, particularly a lot of black folks from wanting to vote in at all in the first place, thinking correctly that their vote was diluted under that law. But now that law is no longer in place. Now, that had previously prevented folks from even trying to participate in elections for governor, but we will not have that racist law in place, that racist Jim Crow law. And Presley is hoping to let black voters know about it and turn them out in record numbers for what would be, to say the least, a stunning upset for the Democrat in Mississippi. If that happened, we are keeping our eyes on both of those races in Mississippi and Kentucky today, of course. There is also an important race for the state Supreme Court, the new justice in Pennsylvania, which will almost certainly be seen as a bellwether for next year's elections, presidential elections in that critical state, which has some 20 electoral votes, which went to Donald Trump back in 2016, and it went to Joe Biden in 2020. So that's a critical race to keep an eye out for on Tuesday. Of course, our focus on the broadcast is always solidly on democracy itself and making sure that those who wish to vote are, in fact, able to do so and able to have their votes counted as cast, hopefully in a way that they can know those votes have been counted as cast. That has become a concern, as usual, in several of the states holding elections on Tuesday, including in Virginia, where the entire state legislature is on the ballot this year. 2 years ago, back in 2021, in the last state election there, as Republican Glenn Youngkin was swept into the governor's mansion over a Democratic challenger, well, Democrats lost control of the state's House of Delegates, but they held on to the state Senate in the Commonwealth by just two seats last time around. That barest of Democratic margins has prevented Youngkin and his Republicans from instituting a 15-week ban on abortion following the Supreme Court's overturning of Roe v. Wade last year. Those two seats in that Senate, state Senate race in Virginia 2 years ago, back in 2021, are the only thing still keeping the right to reproductive freedom in the state of Virginia intact as of now. And all of that could change as of Tuesday when the entire legislature, the Assembly and the House of Delegates and the state Senate, every seat is up for grabs, as we discussed with former Virginia delegate Mark Levin on this program late last week. That and much more is now at stake in what could be a very close election across the state on Tuesday in Virginia. So turnout will be critical, which is why last week, when covering the fact that the office of the Virginia governor admitted that they improperly and, in fact, unlawfully removed some 3,400 voters from the rolls, blaming a state computer program which saw a felony probation violation as an actual new felony. Well, I warned that, you know, while that issue had been discovered in time to hopefully avoid a problem in this week's elections, we need to remain vigilant as voters go to the polls on Tuesday in Virginia and other states, and of course, not just on Tuesday, but beyond, and particularly in states like Ohio, where a critical statewide constitutional initiative is before voters on the ballot that would codify reproductive freedoms into the state's constitution. After the state's Republican governor, Mike DeWine, previously signed a 6-week ban on abortion in the Buckeye state, 6 weeks before many women even know that they are pregnant, and that legislation does not even include exceptions for rape or incest. That measure, that's what's at stake here, and that measure is currently on hold pending Tuesday's election in a state where Republicans are very adept at, frankly, gaming elections, particularly when there's a constitutional amendment on the ballot that will allow for the freedom of choice across the state. Which brings me to a bizarre story that I covered on our show last week. I know Desi has been mourning all weekend since then. It was a bizarre story.
It is very bizarre.
In which I was shocked to learn, perhaps no one more shocked than me, to learn that, in fact, I had died. At least according to a very convincing obituary for myself that was published on the internet as at a sort of sleazy obituary site that was headlined to be an obituary for an entirely different Brad Friedman, who happens to be a lawyer in New York, or was. But the text of the perhaps artificial intelligent, I know Wendell is breathing a sigh of relief that, in fact, I'm not dead. I promise, I'm not. But apparently it was I think, written by artificial intelligence, this obit. It was largely accurate, though, in describing my life, not the New York attorney's. It described my life, you know, my work as a journalist and a radio broadcaster, and how much I would be missed by the progressive community, et cetera, et cetera. Make sure to notice that part. In any event, I described it at the time as a mystery, one of history's great mysteries, as to why that obituary existed at all. I chalked it up to an AI misfire or some perhaps more nefarious scheme. I don't know. But in response to that show, I received quite a few responses from listeners who also seemed happy that I was not dead. So thank you for that. They were offering condolences, you know, for the loss of me. Which I thought was very nice. But a Bradblog commenter, Michael, offered a more disturbing response and a more troubling case of a report of someone dying who wasn't actually dead in the least, writing, "Hi, Brad. I can identify with your story. I received a notice from the IRS after submitting my federal tax return informing me that I was deceased. I was eventually able to reach an IRS advocate, because direct calls to the IRS would direct me to enter personal info, which I did. And after I finished, the voice said, 'Call back when you had the information.' And then the call was terminated because I guess the information he was putting in was no longer valid because he was dead, even though he wasn't. To talk with the IRS advocate, I had to prove who I was. Then I was connected. He told me I was listed as dead. I told him I couldn't be dead because I just proved who I was. He said he believed me, but the computers did not. In frustration, I asked if the computers were in charge of the humans, like in the movie Terminator. He argued that and said that it seemed it was Social Security that had listed me as deceased, and I should call them," said Michael. He notes he eventually reached someone at Social Security, and they told him that there were no records indicating that he was alive. I asked if they could tell that to the IRS. She literally said, "No, it's not our fault." I'm sorry. He said that the records did indicate that he was alive, but that the person at Social Security couldn't tell the IRS because it wasn't their fault. Anyway, I don't know how the quite alive Michael's story eventually worked out, but it did ping in my brain, along with the report of my own death, of course, which I assure you was greatly exaggerated. When I read this from The Guardian over the weekend, all of this came to mind. Ohio's Republican Secretary of State quietly canceled the voter registration of more than 26,000 voters in late September, less than 2 weeks before the deadline to register to vote in Tuesday's hotly contested abortion referendum in the state, and after early voting had already begun. Voting rights advocates say the process lacked transparency and it departed from Secretary of State Frank LaRose's previous practice of alerting voting rights groups before removing registrations from the rolls. It comes as LaRose campaigns hard against the November 7 constitutional amendment vote, when Ohio voters will decide whether to enshrine the right to abortion in the state constitution, as well as a vote on a separate measure, by the way, to legalize marijuana in the Buckeye State. Now, remember, Secretary LaRose, who is now running for U.S. Senate next year, hoping to win the Republican nomination to become the candidate to run against incumbent Democrat Sherrod Brown in the state, LaRose had gamed the system earlier this year after he had successfully lobbied the gerrymandered GOP state legislature to do away with low turnout August elections, saying they had no place, they were expensive, they didn't get anything done. He was successful in that, only to, just weeks later, turn around and lobby the same gerrymandered GOP state legislature to announce a special election in August. And that election, he was complaining, right, that they're too expensive. That election in August would have just one single issue on the ballot, and it would be run across the entire state. It would be a constitutional amendment that would make all future constitutional amendments in Ohio more difficult for citizens to adopt. It would change, among other things, the threshold for passage of constitutional amendments on the ballot from a simple 50% majority to 60%. And of course, that was all meant in hopes of preempting the November ballot issue that would codify abortion rights into the state constitution.
This is the Republican Ohio Secretary of State gaming the system to help Republicans get what they want.
Of course. Now, the good news, that scheme in August failed miserably. It cost millions of dollars to the state of Ohio, and voters easily voted down that measure, which was called Issue 1, voted it down 57 to 43%. But now, here in November, Issue 1 is the measure to approve reproductive rights, to guarantee them in the state constitution. That's confusing on its own that they're both called Issue 1. They didn't have to be, but of course, you know, LaRose. And he is now busy quietly removing voters from the rolls just before the election. As a matter of fact, after the election has already started and military and overseas voters were already voting. Kayla Griffin of the voting rights group All Voting Is Local said, quote, "We are disappointed in the Secretary of State's office authorization of the voter purge while voting for the November election was already underway. Voter list maintenance is a standard, legally required part of the election process, and many, if not most, of these registrations are for people who have moved away, died, or long since stopped voting. But it's unusual, the Guardian notes, to remove voter registrations this close to an election, given the fact that, given the risk of disenfranchising people who intend to vote, but simply missed the memo that they had been flagged for removal. In fact, if this was a federal election instead of a state-level contest, what LaRose has done would be illegal. The National Voter Registration Act prohibits election offices from systemically removing voters from the rolls to clean them up, so-called, within 90 days of a federal election. This one was already underway when Frank LaRose decided it was a great idea to remove 26,000 people from the ballot. Typically, voter removals in Ohio are scheduled in the summer, when there's no elections happening, to afford voters who are affected plenty of time to re-register if they need to. This time, the deadline to remove voters from the rolls came on September 28, nearly a week after military and overseas voting began. Voting rights advocates also say the office did not follow its established practice of alerting them ahead of the purge. According to the Ohio League of Women Voters, the office would typically give, quote, the entire list to groups like ours so that we could, one, make sure that the list was accurate, and two, contact the voters. You know, to make sure, for example, they weren't, maybe they're not dead after all. Which, of course, is a critical issue since, as I can prove, along with Brad Blog commenter Mike, sometimes folks end up on lists of dead people when they are not, in fact, actually dead. And if you're a right-winger out there who has been hoaxed into believing that thousands of dead people are voting in every election, well, you might go out and comb the obits and make sure that, you know, any name you found has been removed somehow from the voting list, even if it's Brad Friedman, the journalist and the reporter who lives in California, who isn't dead at all, but for some reason has shown up in a falsely written obituary. Of course, Ohio Secretary of State Frank LaRose, he knows all of this, which is, of course, why he is, which is why he usually shares the list with these voting rights groups. But he didn't this year, did he? Now that he is putting his thumb on the scale as heavily as possible in order to prevent reproductive freedoms in the great state of Ohio, while he's hoping to win next year's Republican senatorial nomination. So he just doesn't care. He will game the system any way that he can figure out to do so. In 2019, for example, Ohio actually came close to accidentally removing nearly 18,000 active voters from the rolls. That was prevented thanks to the voting rights groups in the state. 10,000 of those voters ended up casting ballots in the 2020 election. So, yeah, thousands of voters can be removed, and it's often the groups like the Ohio League of Women Voters and so forth who discover that there are problems with those lists. LaRose also came under fire again in August when the Secretary of State drafted ballot language for this measure that proponents of reproductive rights called misleading. Rather, for example, instead of referring to a fetus, in the shorter summary that was submitted by advocates, LaRose rewrote the summary, made it longer, and instead of using the word fetus, he now misleadingly refers to unborn child. In January, Ohio passed a wide-reaching law that restricts voting access by tightening photo ID restrictions, allowing less time for voters to return absentee ballots and reducing the early voting period. In the August 8 election this year, voting rights groups observed an uptick in rejected ballots and confusion among poll workers who perpetuated misinformation about the new law. Please note, by the way, that voters whose registrations were removed during that September purge, they can still cast provisional ballots at their polling place or at the Board of Elections, though they may have to take additional steps to prove, for example, that they are not actually dead in the bargain, which sometimes is no easy feat. So, as usual, please, if you're voting on Tuesday, please fight like hell to make sure that you get to exercise that right this year, and make sure you get to do it next year as well. By the way, Ohio media outlets have been making much of what appears to be a very big early voter turnout in Ohio and how much that might affect both issue one for abortion rights and issue two for legalizing recreational marijuana. Early turnout is reportedly much larger than it was in the both in the August special election as well as comparable elections back in 2021 and 2019. But of course, turnout does not necessarily tell us which side is turning out, though early in the early voting, there were larger increases in the state's largest, most Democratic-leaning counties and independent voters in both the larger counties as well as rural counties. Those who favor issues one and two are encouraged, but I would recommend waiting until the counting of votes actually occurs. This is Ohio, after all, a state controlled by Republicans. But for me, you know, it also raises the question, will the issue of abortion rights that up until now has won every single time that it has appeared on the ballot in so-called red states and blue states alike since Roe v. Wade was overturned last year, will that remain an issue for that you know, redounds in favor of Democrats in the 2024 election, or have other issues like the wars in Ukraine and Israel, for example, overtaken that for voters on next year's ballot? We will see. I'd love to hear from some of your early thoughts on that, as we, as I said, are now almost exactly 1 year out from the next presidential election, along with what you may be looking at or for in Tuesday's off-year elections around the country. Give me a call, 818-985-5735, 818-985-KPFK.
Yeah, and I just want to underscore that if you're in any of the states that have elections on Tuesday, seriously, this issue about if you show up and there's a problem with your registration or anything, definitely go ahead and vote provisional. Don't leave. Whatever you do, don't leave. Vote provisional and make sure that you understand what you need to do next to make sure that your vote is validated and counted as cast.
Well said. There has been a lot of misinformation for years out there about provisional ballots. That they're fake ballots, they're not actually counted. Well, they are. They are easier to not count, they're easier to throw out, but by and large, a majority of provisional ballots are in fact counted. So if you're not on the rolls for any reason, you can still vote via a provisional ballot, and I suggest you do. All right, we got to take a quick break. We'll come back with hopefully some of your calls and a story out of Northern California today regarding Tuesday's elections and what may come after it, as the poison, the toxins that Donald Trump has placed into our electoral system, well, continues to poison our democracy. In fact, up in Shasta County. That story and your calls are next on the broadcast. I'm Brad Friedman. Hey, this is Brad here at the Bradcast and bradblog.com. We fight for election integrity all year around, like no other media outlet in the nation. But of course, we need your help to do it. Please stop by bradblog.com/donate to make an automated monthly pledge of any amount you like, or even just a one-time only contribution to help us remain on your public airwaves and completely independent. The fight for voting rights, civil rights, and to save our planet continues. Please help us continue that fight independently over your public airwaves by stopping by bradblog.com/donate right now. Go ahead, do it right now. From Desi Doyen and myself, thank you. Welcome back. It's the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. What did I do with that? Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. Here's the story. I will get to your calls in one moment. 818-985-KPFK, 818-985-5735 on anything we've talked about so far today or anything else you'd like to talk about. There is a bit of a sleeper issue that we will be watching on Tuesday and Tuesday night in the days that follow, which might in its own way in these off-year elections turn out to be more of a bellwether in a different way for next year's presidential election. In many elections, the LA Times recently reported, the suspense comes from wondering which candidate is going to win. In Shasta County, California, however, the question everyone is hanging on is, will the local election Tuesday bring unrest or even violence? The county of about 200,000 people up in Northern California, shout out to our listeners in Redding on KFOI 90.9 FM up there. Would love to hear from you, by the way, via email on this one. You can reach me at bradcast@bradblog.com, bradcast@bradblog.com. But the county made national news last spring when a far-right majority on the Board of Supervisors swept up in unproven election fraud claims, decided to dump the Dominion voting system voting machines and to hand count their hand-marked paper ballots instead. Now, Governor Gavin Newsom and other state officials jumped in to stop that plan when in October the governor signed a law that limits counties from hand-counting ballots in California. In response, Patrick Jones, the chair of the Shasta Board of Supervisors, said he favors a hand count anyway. He declared in the local newspaper, quote, "I believe the new law does not affect Shasta County." Actually, it does affect Shasta County. According to the county's longtime registrar recorder, Kathy Darling Allen, the only Democratic elected official in countywide office in the otherwise very right-leaning county, she said, as a portion of the county's voters prepare to go to the polls to pick a school board member for the Gateway Unified School District and to decide whether to adopt a new fire protection district, Darling Allen said she plans to follow the state law. And that she said that means using machines that the county has purchased to replace the Dominion machines that they just got rid of. The new machines are similar tabulators made by a different company called Hart InterCivic. That stance has infuriated some county residents who subscribe to conspiracy theories that the county's elections have been riddled with fraud because of technology. In other words, because elections can be gamed via this technology. That means, according to some of these folks up in Shasta County, that means that they have been gamed in the county, even as there is no evidence of such gaming to date. Some residents, including some supervisors on the board there, have directed their ire at Darling Allen, who is an elected official. She served as the elected registrar in the county for 2 decades until recently with little or no controversy. They have charged those commissioners that she cannot be trusted to run a fair election. Amid such heated rhetoric, Darling Allen said she hopes for a drama-free election, but she is preparing, along with local law enforcement at this point, to, quote, deal with any potential situation. Quote, hopefully we have a peaceful election and we count the votes, and that's the end of it, she said, but it doesn't escape me that we need to be cognizant and prepared to protect the safety of the ballots as well as our staff and voters at this point. The LA Times notes that unrest has in fact hit the county vote counts in the past. In June of 2022, someone hung a trail camera, the kind that hunters use to track wildlife, in the alley behind the county registrar's office to monitor election staff. During that year's November election, last November, a right-wing activist who once unsuccessfully tried to place all of the county supervisors under citizen's arrest, he tried to push past a barricade in the alley behind the registrar's office. He demanded to be let in until the police arrived. Registrar said she sees all the pushback as part of a national, quote, effort to distract, damage, and destroy the election process, and we are trying our best not to allow this, but there is absolutely a national effort to destroy the election administration as we know it. The new far-right board's majority decision to dump Dominion's machines and embrace hand-counting was supported by prominent figures in the national election denial movement. That would include, for example, Mike Lindell, the MyPillow guy, the prominent pro-Trump election denier. Others were horrified by what was going on in Shasta. Assemblywoman Gail Pellerin, who's been a guest on this program several times over the years, as she formerly served as the registrar of Santa Cruz County, and a very good one at that. She quickly introduced legislation, now as an assemblywoman, to limit hand counting. That put the county on a collision course with the state. So Jones, the chair of the board in Shasta, said, we made this decision before the legislature acted. If they now try to stop us from hand counting, then there will be litigation, which, frankly, let's hope that's all that there is at this point. Tempers are flaring up there. Supervisor Mary Rickert, one of the two board members who voted unsuccessfully to keep the Dominion machines, has said she thinks a fight with the state would be a waste of money and time. Litigating this issue with the state of California is going to cost a tremendous amount of money, she said, and the chances of us winning are practically non-existent, she told her board colleagues last month, saying she's tired of being the embarrassment of the state. In a prepared statement to that board, Darling Allen told members that she had been planning to carry out a hand count following the board vote, but now intended to follow the new state law, which dictates a machine tabulation. She said, quote, I'm deeply disappointed by the chaos and division created by the actions of this board. At no point in my career as a public servant and elected official can I recall being treated as poorly and unprofessionally as I have been over the last year, she said. It must stop. But it did not stop. A group of nonpartisan voting rights organizations sent a letter to the Secretary of State out here in California, Shirley Weber, expressing, quote, grave concerns about the upcoming elections, calling for, quote, urgent, decisive, and sustained response from the Office of the Secretary of State. In response, on Friday, Weber wrote to county officials, warned them to uphold your obligation to comply with the law, adding, failing that, my office stands ready to take any actions necessary to ensure that Shasta County conducts all elections in accordance with state law. Weber did not specify what those actions might be, and her office did not respond to requests for comments from the LA Times, but the standoff is now closely being watched across the country, especially as a precursor to the 2024 elections. We will, of course, be watching closely as well on the broadcast as both the results of Tuesday's elections and the way that they are tallied may tell us more about next year's elections than anything else, including, you know, polling a year out from the 2024 presidential election that some Democrats are freaking out about today. But I'd love to hear from you, 818-985-KPFK, 818-985-5735 on anything we have been going on about. Let me get to James in Los Angeles. Hey, James, welcome to the broadcast. Thank you for holding for a while there. Greatly appreciated. What is on your mind,
Brad,
sir?
Brad, I feel yes. famous. I feel famous being on with you. Thank you so much.
Well,
you know, I heard you make a comment about the referendums that abortion rights are they're always winning, and I think that's because Americans don't like to have rights taken away from them.
Yep.
Like, we have this right. We know we're mature enough to handle it, and then you're going to create. And then you're going to take it away from us. And it's like prohibitions. Like, we know we deserve it.
Yeah. No, I think that is key because it has happened not only in so-called blue states, but also in red states. Kentucky, Montana, Kansas have all had various things. And you're right. They don't like having their rights taken away.
We're not children. We're Americans. We know we can handle it.
Which is why, by the way, in Ohio, Republicans have taken to the idea of falsely claiming that this constitutional amendment to protect reproductive rights will actually take away parental consent rights, which is complete and utter nonsense. But I talked to people in Ohio, and these TV ads are just playing around the clock, telling voters that's what's going on. The governor, the popular Republican governor who was just reelected last year, is telling voters in ads that this is going to take away your rights as a parent to decide what your children do. They're just lies. So the question is, are the lies going to,
it's a losing battle. That's
is
a
it?
Losing battle. You can't take the rights away from Americans. You can't do that. And they must know it. On some level, they must know it.
Well, I appreciate your optimism, and of course, I hope you're right, Famous James. Thanks for calling. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Famous Brad.
818, the late Brad. 818-985-KPFK. 818-985-5735. By the way, just and I'll get back to the calls in a moment, but there's a report out last month from the Society of Family Planning, which advocates for abortion access. This poll shows that the total number of abortions provided in the U.S. actually rose slightly, but it rose in the 12 months after states began implementing bans on them throughout pregnancy following the Dobbs decision overturning Roe. So it shows that the numbers fell to nearly zero in states with the strictest bans, but it rose pretty much everywhere else, especially in states close to those with those bans. Since last year, most Republican-controlled states have enacted restrictions, AP notes, while most Democratic-controlled states have extended protections for those from out of state who are seeking abortion. Allison Norris, a co-chair for the study, said the Dobbs decision turned abortion access in this country upside down. She's also a professor at The Ohio State University College of Public Health. She said in a statement, the fact that abortions increased overall in the past year shows what happens when abortion access is improved and some previously unmet need for abortion is met. But she noted that bans make access harder and sometimes impossible for some people. In all, abortions provided by clinics, hospitals, medical offices, and virtual-only clinics actually rose across the nation by nearly 200 a month nationally from July of 2022 through June of 2023. That compared with May and June of 2022. The states with the biggest increases include Illinois, California, and New Mexico, where state government is controlled by Democrats. But also among them are Florida and North Carolina, where restrictions have been put in place since the Dobbs ruling. In Florida, abortions are banned after 15 weeks of pregnancy, and that could go to 6 weeks under a new law signed by Ron DeSantis, but that will not be enforced unless a judge clears the way for it. But Ron DeSantis has signed that. And in North Carolina, a ban on abortion after 12 weeks kicked in July, but the states still have more legal access than most states in the Southeast. But even where they've tried to ban them, if there's been any wiggle room at all, abortions are actually increasing. The researchers pointed to several factors for the numbers rising, including more funding and organization to help women in states with bans to travel to those where abortion is legal, an increase in medication abortion through online-only clinics, more capacity in the states where abortion remains legal later in pregnancy, and possibly less stigma associated with ending pregnancies. Nationally, the number of abortions has also been rising since 2017. Oh, so since Donald Trump took office, that after years of those numbers actually falling during the Obama presidency. Go figure. 818-985-KPFK, which explains, by the way, why they want to make a federal restriction on abortions. Because the restrictions work in the states where they have them. But if you go next door where they're lawful, well, not so much. And in fact, they're increasing. So, yeah, ban them everywhere. That is the plan. Make no mistake about it. That is what Republicans wish to do. If they gain control of legislatures around the country, places like Virginia on Tuesday, and next year in 2024, as they hope to regain the Senate and the House and the White House. 818-985-5735. Danny in Venice, welcome to the broadcast, sir. What is on your mind?
Hello. I just hear a little echo, but I wanted to ask about something that you said in passing, which was that you were supporting this idea of not allowing hand counting
no.
on the ballots, and I wanted to know. Go ahead.
No, I didn't say that I don't support the idea of hand counting.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I just got in the car, and I was trying to understand why Newsom would pass a law that was not allowing hand counting. Is that what I understand?
Apparently, it limits it, and I'm not sure what those limits are. It was just signed, and I, to be honest, missed it. I didn't see what the details of it were, but I don't think it prevents all hand counting. It certainly doesn't prevent hand counting when it comes to post-election audits or recounts or so forth. But apparently, for the first count, as I understand it, for the first count in California now, it must be a machine count. That's my understanding. If that's the case, I would welcome a fight over that because I support hand counting if it's done properly. The folks up in Shasta,
right. From
what I could tell, had no clue how to do it properly, however. And so I have a feeling that's why folks like Gail Pellerin, who used to be the registrar up in Santa Cruz, why she jumped in and said, look, we're going to have a nightmare on our hands if this moves forward in Shasta. We're not going to be able to certify the election at all. So that's the sense that I get. And by the way, whether I agree with it or not, whether I like the law or not, the law is the law. And you can't just say, oh, we're going to ignore the law, particularly when it comes to elections. Don't you agree, Danny?
Yeah. I mean, I just was wondering what the thinking was behind the law, because I don't like to move back and forth on issues. And I know that you were covering a lot of the kind of actual malfeasance that has happened in the past, not with Dominion, but with some of the other ones, I think Diebold or whoever it was.
Diebold, but no, Dominion as well. None of these machines, all of these machines can be gamed. But, you know, since 2020, Donald Trump came out and claimed that they were gamed without any evidence, I've had to point out that just because they can be gamed does not mean that they were gamed.
Absolutely.
And you know, and there has to be evidence of it. And yet the folks up in Shasta have been actually holding up statewide elections, refusing to certify, even though they have no evidence at all of any kind of gaming. They've just, you know, taken the pillow guy's word for it, basically.
No, yeah, and I totally understand when the wrong people are saying something, and I don't mean that in any judgmental way. I mean, there are some people that have proven by their behavior that they're not trustworthy. So if they say something, I understand opposing it. I just was caught because I have kind of held this belief that if we really wanted to nip all this in the bud, everyone should just only do hand counting, including every election. Because we have the personnel to do it. We have the manpower to do it.
I don't disagree with you at all. There's a lot of people who do disagree with you and who disagree with me on that. One of the points where I would disagree is, you know, I know there's a lot of people calling for hand counted paper ballots, have been for years. While I agree that there must be hand marked paper ballots in order to know that we're actually looking at voter intent, when it comes to hand counting paper ballots, I've called for hand counting hand-counted paper ballot pilots to prove out that it can be done. You know, it's done in some very small jurisdictions, in New Hampshire, for example, other places as well. But can it be done, you know, in 2020 here in California? I think we had 50-something, more than 50, if I recall, lines on the ballot to vote between candidates and initiatives and so forth. Can that be hand counted, Danny?
I don't know.
I don't either.
What do you think?
I think it can be done, but it has to be worked out. It has to be piloted out, and to just do away with the voting machines as they did up in Shasta and say, that's it, we're going to hand counting for the next presidential election. We'll find out how it works afterwards. That ain't the way to go.
Especially if they are not understanding how to do it, because that was the whole premise, was that it's not easy to game hand counting.
Yep.
If a group of people are in a room counting ballots, nobody has the power to, like, change that total.
That's the theory, Danny. I'm sorry, I got to get out. Thanks for that call. Thanks for those thoughts. I got to run. Desi Doyen, our producer, thank you. To our board engineer, Wendell Handy, and to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's program, download it anytime for free at bradblog.com. Drop me email if you like. I'm bradcast@bradblog.com. And on the Facebooks, Mastodons, and sites still known as Twitter, I am the Brad Blog. We'll see you there until we see you here, hopefully tomorrow. I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.
You're listening to the Bradcast. We are 100% listener supported, thanks to listeners like you who drop by bradblog.com/donate.